So just a few short readings from this book called The Reflections on the Art of Personality by Hedayat and I Khan. And these are very sweet, pithy teachings. And this one says, and I think actually Murshid Hedayat said something to this effect just at the beginning of class. Self-denial could be understood as a practice done with the desire to overcome undesirable tendencies, inclinations, and fantasies, in which case self-denial reveals itself as being mastery over the self. I'll read it again. Self-denial could be understood as a practice done with the desire to overcome undesirable tendencies, inclinations, and fantasies, in which case self-denial reveals itself as being mastery over the self. So Murshid Hedayat talked a little bit about desire, the purpose of desire at the very beginning, and how we can use the desire not to be self-indulgent, but use it to activate purposeful action or transformation. And those inner victories make us wise, and they make us enlightened, and they make us certain. They make us have confidence, because we know we can do it. It's like the little red engine that could. Y'all remember that story? It's one of my favorite books. But that's, in a way, what happens. We get very, internally, very strong. I have the tendency to stir things up. Yeah, I do. And I can really agitate and piss people off. Alima, do you know what that means, that expression? Is that an American expression? Mm-hmm. Pissing people off. She's there. But anyway, I can get them a little... It's like kind of beating the wasp nest a little bit.
I believe I do.
Okay. And I often say, oh, I'm so, you know, it, because sometimes the change happens that way, you know. And so, I really invoke people like Joan of Arc, you know. These people really inspire me. And so, I'm not the kind of person that kind of keeps my head down or puts my tail between my legs and goes away. You know, I get on the horse with the spear and go charging ahead. So one can't do that if one's self-conscious and worried about other people's opinions and whether people are going to like you or not like you. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, a little bit, sometimes we have to be spirit. You don't have to do anything. Everyone's fate is their own. But being a spiritual warrior, there are some real benefits. Does that make sense? It's not rubbing someone's face in it. That's a little bit different. But it's when some action needs to be taken up to do it without thought of self. Without thought of self. Tell you, if I was worried about everybody's opinion, I'd probably never leave the house. I'm serious about that. Everyone has one. But my mom used to tell me, do you remember telling me this, Mom? She used to say, Why are you worried about those people's opinions? Do they pay your way in life? Do they pay your bills? I guess that meant when I was younger I needed to really worry about what my mom was thinking, because she was paying my way. But the point is we have to be free. Or at least we're seeking that, I think. So another short reading from this text. The impression that tendencies, inclinations, and fantasies are one's real nature is an illusion, because one is overlooking the fact that there are only an acquired reflection. The impression that tendencies, inclinations, and fantasies are one's real nature is an illusion, because one is overlooking the fact that there are only an acquired reflection. They are only an acquired reflection. So we've decided to keep that image in the mirror. They're an acquired reflection. The power of dominating one's reaction might have the appearance of hypocrisy to those who have not yet understood the importance of gaining mastery over the self. The power of dominating one's reaction might have the appearance of hypocrisy to those who have not yet understood the importance of gaining mastery over the self. This could be a wonderful quote for our young people to reflect on, because there are many things that under peer pressure one might participate in or be a part of. But then if one decides, I'm not doing that any longer, those around them may say, you're a hypocrite. You've done this all along. Now you're above us. You're not with us anymore. You understand how this can play out. And then this is saying here, but it's because they themselves inside haven't understood the meaning of this, that it's a way of gaining mastery. And perhaps in opposing the influence or popular opinion of those around us or their actions. You understand? It happens in the workplace. One may get on the board. You know, I see this with students. We get one agitated student and they spend a lot of time investing other people in their story and getting them behind them, you know. But if one can stand apart from that, it can also have a balancing influence. One last reading from this text. Every word that is said to one need not be taken so seriously that it upsets one, disturbs one's balance, and robs one of one's willpower to control over one's reactions. There are things that matter, and there are things that do not matter. But if one is often tempted to attach undue importance to necessary things, but one is often tempted to attach undue importance to unnecessary things. Any questions or comments about those quotes? So we're continuing our readings of Sufi Message Volume 13, The Gathas, and this is Part 7, The Training of the Ego, Self-Consciousness. and as we heard at the beginning of the class, there is a tendency in man to think a great deal about what others think of him. And in some natures, this tendency develops quickly. This develops in him self-consciousness, which is the root of several defects in man. It enfeebles man physically and mentally, and makes him dependent upon the opinions of others, so to speak. He lives on the good opinion of others, and he is dead when they have had a bad opinion about him. This tendency makes a person sensitive, often hypersensitive. It often reaches such a point that at every word he speaks, he looks around for approval, and every movement he makes in the same way is calculated to produce an effect. This makes his body and his mind both heavy and burdensome to his soul. This makes his body and his mind both heavy and burdensome to his soul. It develops in nature that weakness which in ordinary words is called touchiness, taking offense at every little thing. And the nature of many people is such that they enjoy bringing out any weakness that may be in a person. It's interesting, isn't it? And the nature of many people is such that they enjoy bringing out any weakness that may be in a person. So if you're one is overly sensitive, one may find that people like to pick on you. Mm-hmm. You know. If they may have a pleasure in, sometimes it happens in email, people want to, if you've made a little error, they want to correct you to get a reaction. You see? It's a very interesting thing. That's the, you know, that's the play of the ego. And of course, then there's that impulse to react, which is the play of our ego. But if you do nothing, it's like playing with the tug of war. You know what happens when you let go of the rope to the opponent. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And we don't have to take much energy to do that. Just let go. It becomes a pastime or pleasure to such people, and the life of the one who is sensitive is made so difficult that he has no rest at home or abroad. Everyone seems to him wicked. Everyone's presence seems to have a jarring effect upon him, and he seeks to be exclusive and to find a seclusion which life does not permit of his finding. I hear that sometimes from seekers on the path. You know, they want to change their lives radically so that they can do things a little bit differently because they think life is so jarring. I don't think it's jarring at all. We're not living in the middle of a war-torn village or extreme poverty or where we can't have clean water or food. That, to me, would be really suffering and challenging. If it happens, if he happens to be in a position where he has to speak or sing or perform in any way, he fails to do his best, and when he meets people, he cannot stand a criticism or a reply to jest. destructive in that way. The presence of others has the effect of a weight upon the soul. How can that be? It's just another self in another form. How can it be that others weigh on us so much? The desire of the sensitive person is always to be hiding, keeping away from people, looking at others with nervousness, dislike, or fear. Such a person, however great his virtues or merits, is always incapable of free expression of his gift. The desire of a sensitive person is always to be hiding, keeping away from people, looking at others with nervousness, dislike, or fear. Such a person, however great his virtues or merits, is always incapable of free expression of his gifts. Stiffness in walking, also crookedness, is caused by self-consciousness. And us sitting in a rigid position without any flexibility is caused by the same thing. Self-consciousness gives hardness to the expression of the lips, and it stiffens the tongue and makes the voice toneless, preventing a man from saying that what he wishes to say. Self-consciousness is like a chain upon every feature and limb of the body. And the self-conscious person, and in the self-conscious person, there is nothing of the smoothness that should flow like fluid through every expression of life. So now he's told us all those things, all those indications of self-consciousness. And in this one sentence, he tells us the remedy. Its only remedy is forgetting self and putting the whole mind into work and every occupation undertaken. The only remedy is forgetting self and putting the whole mind into work and each occupation undertaken. What does that mean to you when he says the whole remedy is forgetting self and putting the whole mind into work and each occupation undertaken?
It seems the whole self-consciousness idea is focusing on other, on the outside, rather than on your own self-mastery and yourself. You shouldn't spend any time whatsoever on that. But this, I mean, this is straight. It reminds me so much of hearts to mind, hearts to work, hands to work, hearts to God, the Shakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was thinking about when I teach at school and being in class for 6 hours and how when I go in there, the whole focus is on the students and the class. And that oftentimes, that when I'm done, it's like I realize that so much concentration has gone, and there's concentration.
The word concentration, right.
Has gone into that, that I haven't even taken time to go to the bathroom. You know, it's like I even forget physical, or if I'm not feeling well, I even sometimes forget that I'm not feeling well, mm-hmm. because all of the concentration is going towards others or to that thing which I'm working on, which is teaching.
Yeah.
And so it's just been interesting to be aware of how that happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Giving our whole effort or mindfulness to our activity. Latif.
I think it's confusing for me in a couple of ways. Well, first of all, I think that long description, it's like a mirror. I can see myself in that and throughout my life in so many different ways. But I also feel like there's a lot of people that I am that
absolutely.
I can think about, like a lot of people, and that's not everything applied to one person or to me or to another. But like self-consciousness, I mean the words, I don't know what the connotations are, but the words don't seem so wrong in a sense, like to be aware, to investigate the self. And that's like what meditation in large part is doing. I don't know. I'm just to forget. I don't know. Because what Kareem Gita was describing is that's like one kind of experience.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's not the experience of meditation.
Right. I think everything can become a meditation at one level, you know. And I think that what Murshid is trying to explain to us is to not be so... Here, the self, we could say, is the small self, not the big self, you know. That we're conscious actually, we're becoming very conscious of our own limitations, and we're identifying with those things and always looking in the world to see if other people are noticing those things. Where if we identify with the larger part of ourself, then I can only say the only way to be free is to give up this way of thinking or being.
Of thinking
that we have to be so dependent upon other people's reflection to us.
So that's is that the main connotation?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, and where we then become unnatural because perhaps we're seeking acceptance, recognition, acknowledgement, love, whatever those things might be.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I don't know that I have an answer, but hopefully that offers something.
The thing is, of course, first place, I don't understand what gives another person, one person, the right to criticize and, you know, hurt another person's feelings and, like you say, give them a self-conscience. And sometimes there are people that are like that. But I found out there's one way to get over it, because once they do it, and they're on you like that, you're not going to stop. So I learned one way to do it. Let them criticize you, let them say what they're going to say, and say, turn it off and say some prayers and let it go. Okay. And you get over it. And you know, then they're like, and they're still saying the same thing, but you know what? It's like, okay. Be. But agree with them and smile. Mm-hmm. My mother always said you can say anything with a smile on your face and get away with it.
So I think these teachings are further highlighted with some other supplemental readings, and this is one on character building and the art of personality. And also this may highlight the question of self-consciousness, where Murshid says, self-pity is the worst poverty. Self-pity is the worst poverty. When a person says, I am, with pity, before he has said anything more, he has diminished himself to half of what he is. And what is said further diminishes him totally. Nothing more of him is left afterwards. There is so much in the world that we can pity, and which it would be right for us to take pity upon. But if we have no time free from our own self, we cannot give our mind to others in the world. Does that help highlight this teaching? Life is one long journey, and the further behind we have left ourself, the further we have progressed towards the goal. Verily, when the false self is lost, the true self is discovered. Verily, when the false self is lost, the true self is discovered. I know Karima Gita and I were talking the other day on the phone, and or on Skype, I think we were on Skype. And, you know, there. I think when we come to the path, we're seekers. You know, I mean, obviously that's why we've come. And there is a discipline within the Sufi message where one studies deeply the other religious traditions. That's the school of the universal worship, where one studies the sacred text of the other traditions, and one looks at the purpose for those traditions and how they arose according to a particular time or culture. And one starts to see that although the dissemination of the message is different, there are common threads that have gone throughout these messages. So that's a very focused way of studying, but I do find there are people that become fascinated with knowledge, and they want to go to this group and that group and run here and there and have this experience and that experience. It's like getting badges, like when you're a Girl Scout or a Boy Scout. You know, I don't know what that is, what that thinking is. And we know, we've heard the metaphor many times, that if you can just dig deeply in one place, you will strike oil or you'll find gold. But if you get discouraged and you just go here for a little bit and here a little bit and here a little bit, you end with a lot of holes but not being a benefit. And I've also been told many times, especially by teachers in Tibetan Buddhism, which is a very vast study, it has very many levels of study, that if one just studies one aspect very deeply, it will be the key that will open all knowledge. One thing, one deep understanding. And I said to Karima Gita, the further one gets along on the path, the less complicated one becomes. Didn't I say that to you? One learns how complexity is really not the journey. Simplicity is the journey. I know one summer when Murshid and Murshida Hidayat and Aziza were here, we were sort of joking, you know, because they're often saying, why can't people just be natural? You know, whatever that is for each in person, why can't they just be natural? And I remember the first time Murshid Hidayat entered the house and he sat in that chair where Joe's sitting, and he asked me a question, and I answered him in a very loud voice, and he said, I'm so glad you know how to speak up, and I can hear you, because I know, you know, he has hearing issues. And he said, I don't know why people think it's so spiritual to speak softly. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone wants to speak so softly. What is that? Is that how they speak naturally? I don't know. I doubt it. But and also in public sometimes when people are reading something, they want to you know, what is that? I can't hear you. I remember Murchita Vera saying to me, if you can't project your voice, you shouldn't be teaching. And really, none of us really need microphones. I don't know what that is. It's like being at a Meatloaf concert or something. You know, why can't we just project our voices and use our breath? My commentary.
You have to know who Meatloaf
is. Yeah. Do y'all know who Meatloaf is? Do you, Lynn?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. I sometimes give these examples and I realize that they're generational examples.
Yes.
So verily, when the false self is lost, the true self is discovered. And then there's something from the Social Gothicas, and this is on Divine Manner 1 and 2. And then we're going to do practice. The soul with divine manner is sober compared to the drunken person of the world. This soberness produces in one that purity called Sufism. Through that purity, God reflects in his or her mirror-like soul. The soul with divine manner is sober compared with the drunken person of the world. This isn't, of course, meaning drunken with alcohol, but one that becomes drunk on the world, on material things, on things that are changing. This soberness produces in one that purity called Sufism. Through that purity, God reflects in his or her mirror-like soul. Empty. One's empty, not filled. Nothing frightens the soul that reflects God, for they are above all fright. They possess nothing, and all fright is connected with one's possessions. This also is a reflection of the Tibetan Buddhist teaching on suffering. The suffering of what one getting what one wants, the suffering of getting what one doesn't want, the suffering of losing what one wants, etc., etc. So, you know, if in a sense we don't feel we're possessing anything, then there's nothing to give up and we don't have to be afraid. Does it mean that one leaves the world and passes one's life in caves in the mountains? Not in the least. One may have the wealth of the whole world in one's possession, and one may have the kingdom of the whole universe under one, but nothing binds one, nothing ties one, nothing frightens one. For only that which is one's own belongs to one. And one has to ask what that is. What is it that belongs to us? What is it that belongs to us? When your soul is your own, all is your own, and what belongs to you cannot be taken away. It's very interesting contemplating the nature of impermanence. What was high is low. What was ours today is gone tomorrow. I mean, all you have to do is think about yourself being in love with someone, and then that person you're no longer with, sometimes you look at them and you think, oh, I don't understand. What was I thinking? Do you ever do that? Have you ever done that? We see then this form of attachment that can blind us. And then they say your best friend can become your worst friend. And your worst friend can become your best friend. You never know. Things are not, I love that quote, things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise. and from the Buddhist tradition. Things are not as they appear, nor are they otherwise.
The silence dropped
down. So again, when your soul is your own, all is your own, and what belongs to you cannot be taken away. Only yourself could take it away. You are your own friend and your own foe. So there is no longer pain or suffering, complaint or grudge. You are at peace, for you are at home, whether you are on earth or you are in heaven. I like that quote by the Dalai Lama. Perhaps he's quoting someone else. You might know, Joe. But I like he says, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. So in other words, you know, we can have this pain somewhere. We all will. We get a headache, we get a sore throat, we sprain our ankles, whatever. We get a broken heart, right? That's inevitable. But whether we go around suffering and suffering over it, that's optional. That's our option. Any comments or thoughts about that? So the divine manner too. The difference between God and humankind is that God is omniscient, and we only know of our own affairs. Because God is omniscient, he loves all, and God's interest is in all. So is it with the godly soul. The divine personality expressed through the godly soul shows itself in interest for all, whether known or unknown to that soul. One's interest is not only for another because of one's kind nature or of one's sympathetic spirit. One does not take interest in another's welfare and well-being because it's one's duty, but because one sees oneself in another person. This is a good time for a public service announcement. I know Joe asked before class, can I put a few refugee pictures out? So that's it. I know that many of you are already sponsors, so we're preaching to the choir, but anyone from afar who might want to be a sponsor to a Tibetan refugee, we have information. And you can help someone for $1 a day. How about that? And have direct contact with them. So, one does not take interest in another person's welfare and well-being because it's one's duty, but because one sees oneself in another person. Therefore, the life and interest of another person to the godly soul is as one's own. In the pain of another person, the godly soul sorrows. In the happiness of another person, the godly soul rejoices. Thus the godly soul, who has almost forgotten him or herself, forgets also the remaining part of the self in taking interest in others. Do you need another chair?
I squirm a lot, sorry.
That's okay. If you're uncomfortable, you can, you know, take another seat. I'm sure that for me, that I'm so short, those would be, but you're not short. But those chairs are not quite the right height for me, so I'm uncomfortable in them. You may be too close. Maybe you need more space. You're all like sitting bunched on each other. Maybe it's the energy of other people too. And you can turn the chairs.
It would help me to turn,
actually. Yeah,
thank
turn
you
your
for
chairs
permission.
Because you know I can't do that. I'm always very sensitive. Like when I'm going to go sit at a conference table or something, it's like I always do this before I go in. does my neck feel better that way or that way today? And then I take my chair accordingly because I just don't want to be sitting. And I often turn my chair, even a conference table, so I'm not all twisted. It's not comfortable. Please make yourselves comfortable. Besides, they always say when you walk in the room, you know that, right? If you walk in the room and someone tells you to sit in a certain chair and you just sit, that indicates something about your character. Do you know that? You didn't know this? Oh, I'm going to tell you a good story now. So if you walk in and they tell you to sit down and you just go like this. Or if they tell you to sit down and you go like this, what does that say? Don't you speak for this moment. Does it tell you something?
Well, the first one's self-conscious.
Well, and it's also something else. And then if they say maybe, oh, thank you for letting me take this chair. What does that indicate about the character?
We're taking a little more control.
A little action like that can say so much. I've always heard that. I don't know who told me even that when I go into an interview, always move the chair a little bit. Don't just do what people tell you. People don't really, I mean, only weak people really want people to do what they tell them to do. Strong people want people that think around them. Go ahead, Joe, you're about ready to.
No, okay.
You're going to do some, I know you're going to be doing some talking to other people that are going to be working with you. You're going to be interviewing people.
Okay.
And do you have something you wanted to say about this? Or about this?
No, I said it was probably your mother who told you don't do what other people tell you to do.
Well, that's probably true.
I just had that whole experience.
You did?
In one of my interviews, there were two chairs, and he just said, and I said, hi, nice to meet you and all that, and he said, and I said, should I sit here? And he said, well, you can sit there or there, and where you decide to sit makes a big difference. And I was like, he's just joking. And I just sat down, and then I got really self-conscious.
Right.
And I didn't.
Oh,
I was like, oh. I didn't get the dog.
Run, trick.
Didn't get the dog. See, I would have thought about where, I'm always very, it's probably because I'm Italian, I don't like sitting necessarily, I mean, like, I would not sit right in front of that door. Or in a public place, I usually pick a place where my back can see the whole room. I can see the machine gun coming, you know what I'm saying? I know when to duck. And I don't like sitting with my back to an open door. You know, it's just I think it's genetic coding, you know, having a little Sicilian blood in me or something.
It's good feng shui, too, not to do that.
It is good feng shui. Mm-hmm. You're right. And so, you know, but I would have looked around and decided on what view I wanted to have, or if there was something strong at my back. You know, like, I'm very sensitive to those things, but those are subtle things that we all know, we just aren't always aware of them, you know.
Next time I'll do it.
I want to sit in your chair. That's
yeah. You should have talked to Stephanie before you went on that interview.
Yeah. Yeah, they always say it's not always the person that knows the most or is the best qualified for a job. It's the one that knows how to manage the interview. Yeah. Any other thoughts or questions? I'd like to do two practices before we conclude. The first one is a phrase from the Vedan of Vinayak Khan. And the phrase reads like this, and we'll do it as a breath practice. And the phrase is, let me forget myself, Lord, that I may become conscious of thy being. So here we're forgetting ourselves. This is what Mercer Hadiah talked about. This is what the readings have indicated. And so that we become conscious of what? Not conscious of the self, not self-conscious, but conscious of this divine being. So we can do this practice on the breath. And when one uses the out-breath, that is a way of kind of clearing the space. So for example, just to give, I will divert a little bit here, but this is a very significant instruction that I feel compelled to share. When one is doing the zikr on a fikr, meaning on the breath, when one breathes out the phrase La Elaha and then breathes in Il Allahu, that indicates a purification process. So one is emptying La Elaha, breathing out and breathing in Il Allahu, filling with the divine. And so there is a concentration, and it's very complex. This would be a whole workshop in and of itself. But one is thinking about a kind of centrifugal force with that breath, where all of the dross, the imprints within one's being, are getting pushed out. You know, like those barrel rides you ride at the amusement park? They even have one at Worlds of Fun where you're standing and it starts spinning really, really fast, and then the floor drops out. And the force of the rotation keeps you against the wall, right? Well, this is the point of this exercise. I mean, breath is everything. Direction is everything. So when we're doing that zikr where we're breathing out, it's casting out all those splinters from the personality. And when we breathe in, ilalahu, then we fill with divine qualities. And so during the alchemical process, we use that in the beginning to clear out. In a way, kind of cast out. You know, they say cast out the evil spirit, so to speak. We have those inside of ourselves, those little monsters. We can cast them out. And then, during the other part of the process, when we're building, once we've emptied, we would breathe in, La Elaha, and then out, Ilalahu. So in this way, the force, instead of going out, is coming in. You understand the difference? So you're breathing in, drawing things in, and when you breathe out, they dissipate through your entire being. It's a very beautiful study, of which very few people talk about. Some don't even know. And so we don't often have these experiences, but one day perhaps we do a workshop just on zikr. Really zikr. It's very beautiful. And profound for transformation. This can heal anything. This can transform anything. Truly, it can. But I diverge because I'm using the breath here, so I bring it back to this practice where we're using the out-breath. Let me forget myself, Lord. So we're emptying. Okay, we're clearing the space. It's like sweeping. And then we breathe in. That I may be conscious of thy divine being. So we breathe out. Let me forget myself, Lord. And we breathe in. That I may become conscious of thy being. And we breathe out. Let me forget myself, Lord. And we breathe in. That I may be conscious of thy being. So we breathe out. Let me forget myself, Lord. And we breathe in. That I may become conscious of thy being. Let me forget myself, Lord. That I may become conscious of thy being. Put this phrase on the breath and continue. the words are too complicated or get in the way, that isn't the point. Let me forget myself, Lord, that I may become conscious of thy being. One can always distill the thought, forget myself, conscious of thy being. Forget myself, conscious of thy being. Let me forget myself, that I may be conscious of thy being.